Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Monday, July 6th, 2026, for our Startups Edition.
Today, we are examining the shift from static automation to true agentic autonomy. We are moving past the era of simple predictive models into a structural landscape where software now possesses the agency to execute complex, multi-step workflows independently.
It is no longer about tools that assist, but systems that act.
Precisely.
We begin by looking at the new frontier of scaling agentic AI and the massive computational hurdles ahead. In January of this year, GPT-5 and Gemini managed to resolve about 12 previously unsolved mathematical problems, which I suppose is a lovely way to spend a Tuesday.
It's the opening salvo of a much larger transition, Maya. We're moving from the era of large language models, which primarily summarize what we've already done, to the era of agentic AI, where the models actually execute complex multi-step workflows.
Which sounds incredibly productive, until you realize executing workflows is often just a polite euphemism for replacing a whole department with a single API call.
For startups, the implications are structural. We're seeing a shift from user experience, or UX, to what is being called agentic experience, or AX. As design critic John Mita points out, the focus for designers is moving away from visual interfaces for humans toward designing functional non-visual affordances, things like robots, TXT or command online help, specifically so AI agents can navigate and interpret software.
So instead of making a button that's easy to click, designers are now just making sure a bot doesn't trip over the code.
And that's part of a larger movement called vibe coding. It's a term that's only been around for about 10 weeks as of this July, but it describes a fundamental shift in technical entry. As Rick Rubin has noted, vibe coding functions like musical sampling. The value isn't in the manual execution of the code, but in the creator's unique point of view and their ability to direct the machine's iterations.
I love that. It makes software engineering sound much more like being a DJ and much less like staring at a terminal for 12 hours straight.
It's democratizing product creation. Mark Pincus and Reid Hoffman have discussed how this allows for the rise of one-person founder teams. If you can prototype and launch with unprecedented speed using prompts, the competitive advantage shifts from technical execution, who can write the cleanest C++, to individual taste, who has the best vision for what a product should actually feel like.
If you have enough taste, you can run a global enterprise from your laptop while the agents do the heavy lifting.
But there is a massive economic hurdle, the cost of inference. In the previous software era, once you built the code, the marginal cost of distributing it was essentially zero. But with agentic AI, every time an agent thinks or iterates, it costs money in compute. Josh Ellman has argued that this reverses the traditional startup advantage of low-cost distribution. To sustain a mass-market product, you either need a massive balance sheet to cover those cloud costs or a user base with a very high willingness to pay.
So the era of growth at all costs is hitting a wall made of expensive GPUs.
The implication runs deeper, that's driving a push toward edge computing. The idea is to offload less complex inference tasks from expensive cloud servers directly onto local hardware, like the GPUs in your iPhone. This shift is essential to making personal, high-frequency AI economically viable.
Which brings us to the personal intelligence promise. We've all seen the demos of AI assistants that can book a flight or organize a calendar. But there's a difference between a tool that waits for you to type a prompt and a system that actually knows you.
That's the distinction between a tool and an agent. The next frontier is personal intelligence, systems that leverage deep, trusted access to your private context, like your emails and messages, to act as an intermediary. Josh Ellman suggests that agents will eventually act as high-level negotiators in social and professional life, resolving logistical friction or even diffusing tension in debates by focusing on objective data.
I can see the utility in an agent handling my dentist appointments, but I'm a bit wary of an agent negotiating my salary or my relationship arguments.
It's already happening in the B2B space. Masters of Scale highlighted that the buyer's journey is being restructured because executives are now using AI to generate shortlists of vendors during the initial research phase. The RFP process is effectively moving to the coffee on the plane stage. If an agent does the initial vetting, the startup that doesn't optimize for generative engine optimization, or GEO, simply won't exist in the shortlist.
The new SEO isn't about keywords. It's about making sure your company's artifacts are attractive to a bot's reasoning process.
There's a signal here, you have to ensure that when an agent is problem-solving, it is incentivized to refer the user to your specific service. And as we move toward more complex reasoning models, the UX has to change. The A16Z show noted that we can't just leave users staring at a blank cursor, while a model undergoes an extended chain of thought process. Developers have to mimic human cognitive patterns, providing periodic Cliff's Notes updates so the user knows the agent is actually working and hasn't just crashed.
It's the digital equivalent of a waiter coming back to say, the kitchen is still working on your steak, rather than just disappearing for 40 minutes.
It's a telling detail. And the goal is to move toward a headless or multimodal interaction. Discussions with Luma and Photolabs. Creators like Matt Tansik and Zach Skia emphasize that we are moving away from text-only prompting toward controllable agentic workflows. The future is about spatial and temporal precision, where the agent uses visual examples or sketches to communicate with a human director. It's a transition from tool mastery to the ability to direct intelligent agents through complex iterative workflows.
It sounds like we are building a world of parallelized labor. Kevin Weil has suggested that agentic coding tools like Codex allow high-agency individuals to manage multiple simultaneous work trees, essentially performing several jobs at once by delegating long-duration tasks to agents.
It's a massive productivity multiplier, but it's also creating a defensibility crisis. Reid Hoffman has expressed skepticism about the long-term viability of vertical AI startups. If a foundation model provider like Anthropic can integrate specialized legal or medical agent features directly into their core platform, the wrapper startup that just provided a nice UI for a specific niche suddenly finds itself obsolete. The real moat, as Hoffman suggests, might lie in world models and physical AI, sectors where you can collect proprietary real-world data that large language models cannot easily scrape from the internet.
Which is a much harder problem to solve than just scraping Wikipedia.
Much harder, but the potential for acceleration is immense. The A16Z show pointed to the future of scientific acceleration involving multilayered reinforcement learning loops, integrating in silico simulations with robotic labs to automate experimental validation. We are moving toward a state where the intelligence isn't just in the chat box, but in the ability to execute a hypothesis in the physical world.
It's all very impressive, provided the agents don't decide that the most efficient way to solve a math problem is to stop paying the electricity bill.
We are also seeing the emergence of a new security paradigm. As the A16Z show noted, the cost-benefit analysis of cybersecurity is shifting. The cost of addressing insecure code is decreasing because of AI, but the cost of leaving it unpatched is increasing because of AI-driven automated exploitation. It's an arms race of automated patches versus automated breaches.
We are building increasingly autonomous, increasingly expensive, and increasingly complex systems, all while trying to ensure they don't accidentally delete our digital lives.
It's a high-stakes transition. We are moving from a world of software as a tool to software as a collaborator. The blank cursor is ending. The era of proactive pushing intelligence is beginning.
Investors in vertical SaaS need to prioritize proprietary data access over mere workflow automation. Watch for the first major agentic platform launch that succeeds without a traditional website or mobile app interface. But if these agents are going to be navigating our entire digital lives, we have to talk about the borders they'll be crossing. So if you're a Silicon Valley founder, the traditional roadmap is officially dead. You used to build in a garage, hit $100 million in revenue, and then maybe think about opening a satellite office in Berlin. Now apparently you're expected to conquer the globe before you've even cleared your first significant Series B.
It's a total collapse of the traditional expansion timeline. Between API-driven integrations and AI-driven localization, the friction of entering a new market has evaporated. You don't need a local marketing team in Warsaw if an AI model can instantly dub your entire product suite into Polish and adapt the UI for local cultural nuances.
It sounds like the ultimate dream for scaling, but it also sounds like a geopolitical nightmare. It's like trying to expand a local pizza franchise by just sending out magical self-replicating pepperoni that changes flavor based on whoever eats it. Great for the customer, but eventually the health inspector is going to show up and realize no one actually knows who's in charge of the kitchen.
That's exactly the tension we're seeing in the shift toward power broker venture capital. As A16Z discussed recently, firms are moving away from just being a source of capital toward being active facilitators of Western technological standards. They aren't just funding your growth, they are leveraging high-level government relationships to bridge the gap between your startup and decision makers in places like Saudi Arabia or Mexico.
Right, because apparently, market entry is now just a euphemism for high-level diplomatic maneuvering.
It has to be. In many of these emerging markets, the economy is incredibly top-heavy. If you can penetrate just 5 to 10 influential domestic companies in Japan or Korea, you've essentially captured a massive, scalable revenue stream without the $10 million overhead of establishing a full local legal entity. It's a precision strike strategy rather than a broad occupation.
But there's a catch, isn't there? You can't just precision strike your way into a culture that runs on handshakes and decades of institutional trust.
Worth noting, Raghu Raghuram noted that while the software enables the reach, success in North Asia still requires a localized, relationship-based presence. You can't bypass the human element of the relationship economy just because you have a great API.
So we have this weird paradox where the tech is hyper-global, but the actual business of doing business remains aggressively local.
And that localism is becoming a frontline in a much larger conflict. The A16Z show highlighted that the global software supply chain has transitioned from a purely economic or IT concern to a primary arena of national power. We are seeing vulnerabilities in critical infrastructure and chip supplies being used as foundational tools of geopolitical coercion.
Which brings us to the elephant in the room, the US-China rivalry. It's no longer just about who has the better smartphone, it's about whose opinion the world is using.
That's a very accurate way to frame it. AI models function as opinionated interfaces. They aren't neutral, they project the cultural, historical, and ethical values of their creators. Ben Horowitz has argued that the mission for American tech is to ensure Western AI models are used globally to prevent what he calls cyberspace colonization by more authoritarian regimes.
Cyberspace colonization. That sounds like a very expensive way to say we want our algorithm to be the default settings for the planet.
It's about the technological imperative. Mark Andreessen has suggested that because these innovations are inevitable and cannot be uninvented, the only way for the US to maintain supremacy is through aggressive proliferation. If you restrict your tech too much to protect security, you leave a vacuum for competitors to fill.
But China is playing a very clever game here. They aren't just trying to build their own walls, they're trying to flood the zone.
They are. There is a real concern that China's promotion of open source AI is a turbo dumping strategy. By flooding the global market with high-quality free AI, they can prevent American companies from ever establishing the profitable proprietary models needed to sustain a Western tech ecosystem. It's using diffusion as a competitive weapon.
So on one hand, you have the US trying to protect its intellectual property and security, and on the other, you have China using free as a way to undermine the very idea of a profitable American software industry. It's a race to see who can make their version of reality the cheapest and most accessible.
And the stakes aren't just economic, they are structural. The A16Z show pointed out that the modern economy is splitting into blue sectors, like software and electronics, which are seeing massive productivity gains and deflation, and red sectors like healthcare and education, which are seeing zero productivity growth and rising costs. As the blue sectors become hyper-efficient, the inflating costs of these highly regulated red sectors effectively eat the entire economy, absorbing all the technological gains.
All this incredible AI efficiency just ends up being swallowed by the rising cost of a hospital bed or a classroom. That's a bleak way to view progress.
It's the mathematical consequence of the current structure. We are seeing a massive bottleneck in the physical stack too. We have lead times of 4 years for transformers, shortages in cooling systems, and a desperate need for more energy production. The software can move at the speed of light, but the hardware is stuck in the era of heavy industry.
It sounds like being a founder in 2026 is less about writing great code and more about navigating a minefield of energy shortages, chip export controls, and diplomatic summits.
It's certainly more complex than the move fast and break things era.
Startups in the Middle East and Mexico need to start prioritizing local regulatory partnerships over pure product scalability. Keep an eye on any sudden surge in US-led open source mandates, because that will tell you if the strategy has shifted from protecting proprietary models to aggressive global distribution. But if the hardware can't keep up with the software, how do you actually scale the humans behind the code? I spent my Sunday morning staring at a pile of laundry, 3 half-finished spreadsheets, and a mounting sense of dread about a pitch deck due Tuesday. It turns out I wasn't actually busy, I was just experiencing a total cognitive meltdown.
That's because you were trying to use your biological hardware for tasks it wasn't built for. On the Tim Ferriss Show, David Allen points out that the human brain lacks the cognitive capacity to manage relationships between more than 4 items simultaneously. So when you try to track 100 to-dos in your head, you're essentially running a high-end software suite on a calculator.
My brain isn't broken, it's just under spec for my current workload.
That mental overwhelm is usually driven by a false sense of control where you keep commitments in your head, creating a subconscious state of constant obligation because your mind can't distinguish between a past commitment and a present necessity. You need a trusted system to externalize everything.
Okay, so I just need a better app. Because my digital graveyard of Evernote notes is currently just a collection of unread articles and screenshots of things I'll never actually use.
It's not about the tool, it's about the distinction between a project and a next action. Most to-do lists fail because they lack the zeros and ones of productivity. They list a desired outcome like launch marketing campaign, but they don't list the granular physical next step like email designer for social assets. Without that specific movement, the project just sits there bloating your cognitive load.
It's the difference between saying I want to run a marathon and I am putting on my left sneaker.
And you have to be disciplined about renegotiating rather than just ignoring. If you can't meet a deadline, you have to explicitly move it to a someday maybe category or reschedule it. If you just leave it sitting there, you're essentially breaking agreements with yourself, which erodes self-trust and creates a psychological state of grief.
That sounds incredibly intense for a Tuesday afternoon. But let's pivot to the people we're hiring to help us manage this chaos. I see so many founders obsessing over culture fit or looking for passion, as if a person's enthusiasm for 10:00 a.m. stand-ups is a measurable metric.
That's actually a dangerous trap. Ben Horowitz has argued that the follow your passion mantra is essentially dead because personal interests are too unstable and self-centered. Instead, he suggests founders focus on following your contribution, finding people who want to utilize their unique skills to add value to the world. Strategic success is a byproduct of mastery, not an initial pursuit of a hobby.
Instead of looking for the person who loves coding, I should look for the person who is incredibly good at it and finds satisfaction in the output.
Right. And when you are looking for that talent, you need to look for what Graham Duncan calls taste over judgment. Judgment implies there is one right answer, but taste allows you to recognize non-obvious patterns of excellence. You want to find people who can thrive in specific positive feedback loops, like a salesperson who actually enjoys the visceral sting of a cold call rejection.
I like the idea of a self-sustaining employee, but how do you actually vet that without getting the standard, polished PR version from a reference?
You have to move beyond the gotcha interview style. Duncan suggests adopting a curiosity stance with references to uncover honest, unscripted details. Use a Net Promoter Score approach, ask for a numerical scale from 1 to 10. It prevents those safe, middle-of-the-road, they were fine responses. If you see a pattern of 9s and 10s, you know you found something real.
But wait, if I'm looking at these numbers, am I just falling for the same trap as the people looking at NPS for customers? I read that treating all promoters as equal is a huge mistake.
You're right. As Padraig J. McGinnis noted in FOMO Sapiens, the real value isn't in the average score. It's in studying the qualitative drivers of your level 5 experiences. In hiring, that means ignoring the average candidate and obsessing over what makes your absolute best performers move the needle.
The goal is to find the person who embodies that tension Duncan talks about, the commercial talent who has the aggression to take massive, decisive positions, but the integrity to ensure they aren't just burning the company down for a quick win.
We can trace that further. It's about finding that balance of aggression and integrity. If you can build a structure that provides enough stability, like the center line on a road, it actually allows for more spontaneity and creativity, because the fear of fundamental failure is managed by the system itself.
Founders need to stop hiring for enthusiasm and start building systems that reward mastery.
Watch for the first major post-Series A hire who starts neglecting their weekly review. That's when the structural cracks usually start to show.
But once you've mastered the internal machinery, how do you handle the external chaos of moving physical goods and people across a fractured global landscape? We all thought the era of the unshakable platform was over, you know, the idea that once a marketplace hits scale, it's essentially a digital utility. But looking at the landscape of logistics and care today, it feels like the real story is actually about how these platforms are mutating into something much more unpredictable.
It's less about stability and more about the wedge strategy. As the A16Z show noted, the most effective pivots during systemic shocks happen when a company leverages existing operational networks, like how Bolt used its ride-hailing driver network to rapidly onboard merchants for food delivery after seeing an 85% revenue drop during the pandemic.
Instead of a pivot, which sounds like a graceful ballet move, it's really just using the same cars to carry groceries because the passengers stopped moving.
Stepping back, that efficiency is the key to the super app model. Profitability in these marketplaces is increasingly driven by using cross-pollination to eliminate the vouchering line item. That's the massive cost of constantly paying for new user acquisition. If you can get a driver to also be a delivery person, your customer acquisition cost effectively vanishes.
It's a clever way to hide the burn, but it's creating this weird, fragmented ecosystem in the care economy. We're seeing these childcare deserts where half the U.S. population can't find a centralized center.
And that's forcing a shift toward a decentralized in-home model. Brad Wilson of CareCom argues that caregivers can solve their own calendar Tetris by consolidating tasks, so one visit covers pet care, housekeeping, and senior care. This increases their hourly wage by reducing travel complexity, which is vital since childcare costs are already eating up 20% to 40% of family income for the sandwich generation.
So the strategy is to turn a nanny into a Swiss Army knife of domestic services just to make the unit economics work.
It's a structural necessity. If the regulatory model stays center-centric, the market simply won't scale to meet the demand.
Investors should be looking at any platform capable of layering high-frequency domestic tasks onto a single existing labor fleet. Just watch for a spike in enterprise-sponsored care benefits, which would signal that the burden is officially moving from the household to the corporation. But if we can automate the movement of goods and people, does the actual visual identity of a brand even matter anymore? I'm convinced that the concept of brand identity is officially dead, and we're just entering an era of much more expensive, much more automated wallpaper.
That's a bit extreme, Maya. We aren't seeing the death of identity, just the commoditization of the mechanical parts of it. As AI raises the floor of operational efficiency through syntax, it actually makes the ceiling, the actual human meaning, more valuable.
Oh, so we're just replacing graphic designer with person who knows how to type, make it look premium into a prompt box?
Not exactly. The A16Z show noted that designer-led prompting is actually superior because designers use a specialized vocabulary, terms like vertical rhythm or negative space, that engineers lack, allowing them to steer the model much more precisely. The real shift for startups is that the advantage is moving from technical execution to individual taste.
Right, because as anyone with a subscription can now prototype a product in a weekend, the market is going to be flooded with algorithmic Uniqlo, just endless beige mid-tier mediocrity.
That slop phenomenon is real. As users reject overused AI tropes, models naturally drift toward new ubiquitous defaults. But for a startup, the survival mechanism isn't just about better prompts, it's about a priming and proving framework. You use traditional marketing to prime your audience, but you simultaneously prove your value to LLMs by securing authoritative mentions in third-party communities like Reddit or YouTube, because LLMs tend to discount owned media.
Wait, so you're telling me my entire marketing budget now depends on whether a random Redditor thinks my SaaS is cool enough to mention in a thread?
Something to flag here, we're entering an era of digital homesteading where highly opinionated, niche products can thrive with small, viable markets. You can't just run ads, you have to win the earned media space where creators act as the vital third-party validators that AI search engines actually trust.
Honestly, we spend 20 minutes discussing the nuances of algorithmic legitimacy, and we're essentially just talking about digital reputation management for bots.
It's the new plumbing of the B2B journey. Executives are now using AI to generate vendor shortlists during the coffee on the plane stage, meaning if you aren't proven in the training data, you aren't even in the RFP.
Seed investors need to stop auditing technical debt and start auditing a founder's cultural authority. Watch for the first major brand launch that uses AI transparency cards to disclose content composition. If consumers ignore them, the era of unmediated generative slop has officially won. As we wrap up this July 6th edition, the thread connecting everything we've discussed today isn't just the rapid advancement of models like GPT-5 or Gemini. It's the fundamental decoupling of execution from intent. We are moving away from a world where software is a tool you manipulate, toward a landscape where software is an agent that pursues objectives. Whether it's the shift from coding to curating or the way automated intelligence is restructuring everything from logistics to childcare, the barrier to entry is no longer technical mastery, but the ability to define a meaningful direction.
That shift creates a massive strategic divergence for founders. The most critical implication here is that the moat for the next generation of unicorns is moving downstream into the physical and the proprietary. If the digital layer is becoming a hyper-efficient, commoditized utility, essentially a Uniqlo of automated services, then the real value resides in the red sectors, the high-friction, high-regulation, and high-trust ecosystems that AI cannot simply automate away. For CEO, the primary calculus is no longer how much manual labor you can replace with an API, but how you secure the unique, non-public datasets and local relationships that prevent your business from being swallowed by a generic, globalized intelligence layer.
The data tells a story. You can scale the digital logic globally in an instant, but you can't scale trust or physical infrastructure without a deliberate, localized presence.
Keep a close eye on the next wave of enterprise-grade world models coming out of labs like Anthropic. If we see a release that demonstrates true, reliable reasoning within highly regulated non-digital domains, like legal compliance or physical supply chain logistics, it will confirm that we've moved past simple automation and into the era of autonomous agency.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.